Welcome to the podcast of First Presbyterian Church of Marietta, where we are committed to changing lives with faith, hope, and love. We're so glad you are here.
All right, so the Dead Sea Scroll, the phrase the Dead Sea Scrolls can describe not just the community we're going to be focusing on today, which is the community that is referred to with the modern name of Qumran, which is an Arabic word that just names a region, this kind of area, on the northwest of the Dead Sea. And there was an ancient community there, which there are archaeological remains that exist still today. When I say the Dead Sea Scrolls, I'm referring primarily to this community, which seems to have hoarded many thousands of scrolls in the ancient world. But also the Dead Sea Scrolls can refer to many other finds of scrolls along the especially western shore of the Dead Sea. A lot of these scrolls date to the time of the Second Temple period, that is to the time that we're talking about in this class, but also to the time of Jesus and even after the time of Jesus. That is to say, some of these scrolls seem to be documents from the Roman period, and many of them, the reason that they're in these caves in the Dead Sea seems to be because during the fight with Rome, around about the year 67 to 70 AD, when Jerusalem was destroyed after the time of Jesus, that is around 70 AD, many Jews fled from Jerusalem and took with them their possessions, their most sacred possessions, including many of their manuscripts, and hid them alongside caves, along these caves, along the Dead Sea in a very inhospitable territory. So the place we'll be talking about today is named Qumran. It's about 10 miles east of Jerusalem and about 10 miles south of Jericho. That is to say, it's near some inhabited large cities. Even at the time in the ancient world, these were large inhabited cities, large for that period at least, but fairly inaccessible. That is, through very rough terrain, of which there were not great roads. So we have a fairly inaccessible area next to an inhospitable sea, right? A sea made of salt, the salty water. Of which there wasn't a whole lot of farming. There is an oasis near Qumran, and there was an oasis in the ancient world near Qumran, but it would have been a difficult place to live. So these other places like Nahal Heber and Masada, these are places to which the royal family fled in times of crisis throughout the reigns of the Hasmonean kings, but also into the time of Herod and the Roman era. During the destruction of Jerusalem, the elite fled to Masada, and there was an ultimate battle there. We'll talk about this when we talk about the history of the Roman period, our last week of this session in December. So, all to say, when you talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls, you can talk about any of these different types of texts, but Qumran was different. Qumran was different precisely because it was not a place where people just fled in times of crisis. It seems to have been a working community of some sort. The identity of it is kind of difficult to figure out, so we'll get to some of that those details in just a moment. This was an actual functioning group of people who lived there permanently in the wilderness, whereas the other Dead Sea Scroll finds are primarily luxury texts, deluxe luxury texts that were brought there by wealthy people or elite who fled there in times of crisis and hid their possessions. This is what we imagine Qumran would have looked like. If you just Google kind of ancient Qumran or something like that, you can find many of these reconstructions of the site. It would have been near again an oasis next to what's called a wadi, the Wadi Qumran. That's the modern name for it. We don't know what they called it back then, but a wadi is basically a river that fills up only in times of downpours. You know, this is a desert area. The desert doesn't mean that there's no water. It just means that water comes at inopportune moments, right? So there's lots of floods that occur. And so managing these, there's kind of dry riverbeds that will suddenly fill with water during torrential downpours a few times a year. So managing this water supply was a big part of this community. You can see even in some of these reconstructions, some of these cisterns and wells and so on. And we'll get back to why the water was so important in just a moment. So this community, again, arose during the period of the Hasmoneans, that is the Greco-Roman era dynasty that we've been talking about so far, that starts with Mattathias and the Hasmonean revolt, revolting against the Antiochus IV, the Seleucid Greek ruler, who persecutes the Jewish religion. Mattathias' son Judas Maccabeus takes over early in the revolt after Mattathias' death. Remember, they're priests from Modiin, a small town near Jerusalem. Oh, yeah. And Judas Maccabeus dies in the middle of the revolt, but after he has reconquered at least part of Jerusalem and reestablished the temple, that's Hanukkah, the story of Hanukkah, Jonathan, his brother, takes over, and it seems to be during the period of Jonathan's rule, really as general, they haven't quite become kings yet. Simon is the first one to actually sue for full peace from the Seleucid Empire and receive an actual peace treaty and be recognized as a king by the Seleucid Empire. But it seems to be during the reign of Jonathan, or during the rule of Jonathan, who might have styled himself a king but didn't quite call himself that, Jonathan actually is the first of the Hasmoneans to fully take over the job of being high priest, sometime around 150 BC. So right around 150 BC, Jonathan deposes some of the people who would have called themselves high priests in the temple, this Zadokite family that goes all the way back being high priests, right? There was this kind of a turmoil that was started really by Jason, the brother of Onias III, the rightful high priest who had this family lineage that goes all the way back to the time of Zadok, who was David's high priest in Jerusalem back around the year 1000 BC. In 175 BC, Jason, the brother of Onias, remember, buys the high priesthood, kicking off a series of crises that eventuate in Antiochus IV, the Greek king, persecuting the Jewish faith. So this fight over the high priesthood is actually hugely important. When Jonathan seizes the high priesthood, there seem to have been a number of disaffected priests. You might have called these people Sadducees. That is to say, part of this Sadducee comes, that word comes from Zadok. It's a kind of a permutation of the name Zadok, the high priestly family. The priests would have had their own ideas about how to run things, and especially some of these subgroups of priests probably would have very specific ideas about how to run things. One group, we don't exactly know who, that is to say, this is an anonymous, all the texts about this are anonymous. They refer to somebody as the teacher of righteousness, was persecuted by someone that these scrolls call the wicked priest. So we don't know who the wicked priest and teacher of righteousness are. They don't use names. But perhaps someone had suggested Jonathan is the wicked priest for seizing the high priesthood and claiming it for a family that wasn't rightfully his, right? The Zadok family, the Zadokite family. There were certain priests that seemed to have been disaffected by this, and they eventually, after a long period of time, it seems, moved, maybe 50 years or so, moved into the wilderness and founded this community at Qumran. What we have today are remains of this community that ended up living all the way through the time of Herod the Great and all the way into the time of Jesus and past the time of Jesus. That is to say, this community was inhabited and working as this kind of like priestly outpost, disaffected priestly outpost, all the way up to the time of the Roman destruction of Jerusalem, when Qumran was also destroyed. That is to say, around 68 A.D., when this group was destroyed, they seem to have hidden in caves around their community scroll jars, which held their most precious possession, thousands of scrolls. Really, we've recovered about 900, like 50,000 fragments, but composing about 900 scrolls, but there were probably more that we've lost. So all to say, over 1,000 scrolls were held by this community.
Brennan, are they yes. still recovering?
There are some that are in private hands that scholars have never seen that we've heard tell of. There, I'm sure, are others that have disintegrated in the meantime. So we'll get to some of the stories of how they were found in just a minute. But just to remind you, I talked a couple weeks ago about sectarianism, Jewish sectarianism at the time of the Second Temple period. That is the splitting into these different groups. We said the Sadducees, a priestly group, seems to have formed, we know that there were different subgroups of Sadducees. Right? And over time, this phrase probably changed a lot in terms of what it meant. In the same way that if you go back 150 years before now, and you ask what did the terms in the South, Democrat and Republican mean, they didn't mean the same thing they meant today. Those words and what they represent have changed over time, and the constituencies they represent have changed over time. That same thing we assume has happened with Pharisee and Sadducee. We are most familiar with Pharisee and Sadducee at the time of Jesus as Christians. But imagine 150 years before Jesus. These words probably meant something slightly different, at least. So when we talk about Josephus, we're talking about someone after the time of Jesus who's telling us what he thinks these words mean. We're going to see another perspective on perhaps what Sadducee might have meant, but also what Essene might have meant a long time before Josephus. So Josephus told us about this group called the Essenes, which have long been held in the scholarly community to have something to do with this community at Qumran. And Josephus tells us that these folks believe that God basically controls everything. God, you know, they are the total predestinarians, right? Yeah. They would have loved John Calvin, right? God controls your life down to the merest detail. But there's a problem in connecting this group with Christianity, which I'll get to later. So all to say, here's another map of Qumran. You can see that the general area is a dry, desert, hilly, treacherous area right near the northwest shore of the Dead Sea. The community of Qumran seems to have been this kind of rocky outcropping. Overlooking the Dead Sea itself, near an oasis, but not fully reliable for water. Today, that area is farmed. It is possible that in the ancient world, this area was slightly wetter than it is now. That is to say, there might have been. We have some records on the western slopes of the Dead Sea, some record of agricultural production right around the time of the Roman period. Mark Antony even came and seized a part of it and gave it to Cleopatra because there was a special kind of resin that was produced by the trees there that was particularly pungent and aromatic. So that is to say, there might have been more going on in the western shore of the Dead Sea in the ancient world. But even at that time, we can tell from archaeological evidence that Qumran would have been a very strange place, a permanent permanently inhabited settlement with lots of people living on these cliffs overlooking the Dead Sea. By the way, this is the modern community, the modern archaeological remains of the ancient community, and you can see it's on this kind of area with cliffs overlooking the Dead Sea here, and you can see this is the archaeological remains of the community. It would have been a fairly large settlement. There's a cemetery nearby with about 1,000 graves, so it seems to have been populated by a number of folks over a long period of time. And these caves over here, some of these caves nearby are caves where the scrolls were found. So the scrolls were not found in the middle of the settlement. The scrolls were found hidden in caves nearby, perhaps to hide them from the destruction that they knew was coming from the Romans, to preserve them. So how do we know that these things exist? Well, the site of Qumran itself was known from to Western archaeologists, even from the 1850s. In 1851, we have a report of a French archaeologist talking about this site. They knew it existed. They didn't know what it was. It was kind of a mystery. Why is there this big building out here? People proposed that it was a fortress or something like that. And, of course, local Bedouins knew about this for many centuries and had scoured the site itself. What they didn't know was that nearby, hidden in these caves, that there were some treasures. The story goes, and I say the story goes because we don't actually know what happened. What we have are kind of reconstructed bits of these stories. The story goes that there were two Bedouin goat herds, Juma and Muhammad el-Dib. This is Juma on the left and Muhammad on the right. The story goes that Muhammad was chasing a goat that had kind of gone astray and that he was throwing rocks into caves, just kind of trying to pass the time, and he heard a crash. And then he goes back the next day and inspects the cave where he had thrown this rock and heard a crash and finds jars. These jars here, here's one of the caves. You can see one of these, the caves are kind of nearby this archaeological site. Some of the caves are over here, right? But the cave he actually threw it into was actually north of Qumran, a decent walk from Qumran, actually, from the actual archaeological site. And he found some of these jars in the cave. So as he wandered up into the cave, little image of these caves are actually quite sizable. He found a bunch of these jars, and the one that he had broken open had a scroll inside it. You can see a leather scroll, parchment scroll. So some of these were very long. Some of these were amazingly intact. And later on, people discovered that these scroll jars, some of which seem to have been made at Qumran, like the radiocarbon analysis of them shows that the clay actually comes from a nearby site. So they were made on site, some of them. They were capped, the scrolls inside, and then for quite a long time, bats lived in these caves, and the bat guano, or the bat dung, actually sealed and literally created an airtight seal over these jars, which preserved their contents in the very dry, right, not very humid environment of the Dead Sea for 2,000 years. So quite an amazing thing, right? Of course, once you take these things out of the jars and then you start taking them to more humid environments, they start to decompose. So they start, and there's a few papyrus scrolls as well, and those decompose even faster. So once you break open the airtight seal, your time is limited. So the Bedouin goat herds, they take these scrolls. They don't quite know what to do with it. It seems that they spend even about a year trying to figure out what to do with them. They finally end up taking them to Bethlehem. Here's just another image of what this might have looked like, this kind of scroll jar storage units. Again, none found, none of these scroll jars, and no scrolls found on the archaeological site of Qumran, which has led some scholars to say maybe these things don't relate at all. Of course, I think they do. Why else would people hide thousands of scrolls in these caves right next to an archaeological site that where people were living at the time? No one else was living there. So I'll just say, I think they're related. Some of these scrolls were calcified and very difficult to open. Some of them have only been opened kind of digitally, like using a digital spectral analysis to try to figure out what was written on them. So in any event, the Bedouin, they have in particular four large scrolls they find in one
Where
of the caves.
This? 1940?
Sorry, 1946. Six. 1946, which, if you might remember from your history, 1946 in this part of the world, there's a mandate, right? Palestinian mandate, right? So the British kind of run this area, and then the British kind of pull out, and the United Nations ends up trying to create the State of Israel, and then there's a war, right? So the 1948 war, so the Jordan owns part of this territory for quite some time. So there's a tricky history in terms of who, the legal history of these texts, who actually owns them is a really interesting question. So, but these four, these Bedouins, two Bedouin shepherds seem to have these four large scrolls, ancient scrolls, and they bring them eventually, after about a year's time, it seems, to this guy named Kendo. This is his nickname, Kendo, who was a Bethlehem antiquities dealer. He was a Christian Arab, so very interested in like kind of some of the religious aspect of the scrolls. But he himself pays about $100 for these four scrolls because he doesn't know if they could be forgeries. There's a live and very active black market for these sorts of things where lots of forgeries exist. You've probably heard about some of these forgeries in recent years that even have pulled the wool over certain scholars and so on. So in any event, here's Kendo. Kendo ends up going and selling them to Archbishop Samuel, the head of the Syrian Orthodox Monastery of St. Mark in Jerusalem, and he was sort of in charge of the Syrian Orthodox Church in that region. So he's an important local Christian leader. Again, this Bethlehem antiquities dealer, himself is a Christian Arab, goes and shows them to someone who he's related to spiritually. Bishop Samuel, ends up kind of saying, well, I'll buy them, right? So he buys them from Kendo, and then he has them on his hands, and he doesn't quite know what to do with them. Meanwhile, in 1948, there's a war that breaks out, and Mar Samuel leaves Jerusalem and goes to New Jersey. So he's in New Jersey now with these four scrolls and trying to figure out what to do with them. Also, he doesn't quite know if he has legal right to have them. Meanwhile, the State of Israel begins to hear about these things, and they really want these four scrolls because it'll be an important part of their own history, but also part of their project of political legitimation for the State of Israel, right? So all to say, like, there's a lot of machinations happening. Mar Samuel isn't really interested in selling them for at least a little while, but then ends up realizing that these things might be worth a lot of money, and he places an ad in the Wall Street Journal. You can see the date up here, June 1st, 1954. So he waits a few years. Some scholars end up getting a hold of some pictures. So he has somebody from the American Society of Archaeology take some pictures of these and show them around. It's actually American Society of Oriental Research, ASOR. Someone ends up taking some pictures of them, sends them to some scholars. The scholars say, these actually look pretty legitimate, and it looks like there's some pretty interesting information in here. So he ends up putting them up for sale. And the ad reads, "The Four Dead Sea Scrolls." This is in June 1st, 1954, miscellaneous for sale. Miscellaneous for sale, I love that. And it says, "Biblical manuscripts dated back at least 200 BC are for sale. This would be an ideal gift for an educational organization to buy an individual or group. Box F, 206, Wall Street Journal." So, basically, a bunch of people end up getting in touch with the Archbishop, Archbishop Samuel, and he ends up selling them for about $250,000 to a personal collector, who is not actually a personal collector, but works for the State of Israel. And it's somebody undercover ends up getting these, and then the State of Israel builds this thing called the Shrine of the Book to house them, where you can still see some of them today. So these four main scrolls, which include the Isaiah scroll, which is the largest complete biblical manuscript in the ancient world that we have access to, and also the Pesher Habakkuk, like one of these kind of commentaries on Habakkuk, this is kind of a large scroll, and the community rule. So some of these texts I'll talk about a little bit later, you can go see them today in the Shrine of the Book. And today it has seven scrolls that Israel ended up acquiring the state of Israel over a number of years. Meanwhile, there's a team of scholars that end up collecting in East Jerusalem in an institute built by Rockefeller money. So now it's called the Rockefeller Museum in East Jerusalem. At the time, it was called something else, but everyone knows it as the Rockefeller Museum. And there was a team of scholars, international team of scholars, who began to look at some of the other scrolls that had been uncovered. In the meantime, many Bedouin, but also some other archaeologists eventually end up going to scrounge around the caves, all the caves around Qumran, and ended up discovering a lot of other caves. Again, there was just one cave discovered first, Cave 1. And eventually, we have up to 11, or actually 12 caves that have been discovered with texts in them. So you know, people are kind of end up pulling 50,000 fragments of text out. And many of these end up collecting at this Rockefeller Institute so that scholars can study them in something called the Scrollery. You can probably see some problems here. That is to say, these ancient texts held under heavy glass with light pouring on them at all hours of the day, they start to disintegrate. After they start to disintegrate, there's some work that has been done to try to actually preserve them. Now they're being held together by pieces of cardboard, not heavy glass, so they they're held in airtight environments and so on. They're not exposed to light very much anymore. So, but for many years, they were held in conditions like this. I remember one of my advisor. Well, at one point, I was talking about how she actually worked on the Dead Sea Scrolls. She went to Harvard for her for a PhD, and John Strugnell, who was for many years the head of the Dead Sea Scrolls project, not without some controversy, for her dissertation, ended up handing her just a box of scraps of paper, ancient parchment, right? And it's like, figure these out, right? So she ends up working on what became the Songs of the Sabbath Sacrifice, which is a bunch of songs that people sang in this community, some hymns. So in any event, in the 1967 war, Jordan owned this territory, was in possessed this territory during the time, East Jerusalem, during the time of the Rockefeller Museum, and the early scrolls work. After Israel comes to possess this territory, after the war, they end up kind of allowing many of these scholars to continue working on this project, but also the kind of institution of the Dead Sea Scrolls changes in many ways. Meanwhile, archaeologists start to systematically dig not only the caves, but also the community, try to figure out who these people were and why they lived there. This is Roland DeVoe, who was a French archaeologist and priest, who ended up leading the international expedition and for many years was in charge of the archaeological project there at Qumran. So they ended up, as I said, uncovering many caves. Really, caves 1 through 11 are the ones that have scrolls in them. Some of them didn't have any scrolls at all. Cave 1, Cave 4, and Cave 11 have the most scrolls. Cave 2 had some. But Cave 4 was really the mother lode, and that was the one that was actually one of the closest caves to the inhabited area of Qumran itself. So if you're standing at Qumran, here's a little picture here. Caves 1 and 2, Cave 11, Cave 3, Cave 11, Cave 13... these kind of go up this mountainside over here. They're quite some thing. It's a good walk from Qumran to get to some of those caves. But caves 4 and 5, cave 4, especially where the most scrolls were found, was actually closest to Qumran. Here's a little image of the cemetery, which was nearby, but not right in the community. And in part, we'll get to why that would have been in just a moment. Here's another image of some of these different caves that you can see the inhabited area was up here. And these caves are down a cliff. This is the Wadi, the area where water from torrential downpours that happen just a couple of times a year would have poured into this area, and that's where the community would have gotten their water. Yeah.
Are the caves natural or man-made?
The caves are natural. Yeah. They're naturally formed by this activity, this water cascading all through and breaking holes in rocks and things like that just a few times a year.
Brennan, did they have people like the 49ers and the Gold Rush that would just try to come in to make money? I mean, could they keep just the public out?
Well, today it's a park. Today it's a national park for the State of Israel, and it's policed and so on. But in the 1940s, so again, starting in 1946 and going up into the 1950s, it was not well policed. So that is to say, the site was a site for looters and raiders, yeah. But also just people who are looking for, like, people going to explore what was there, right? And if you're a Bedouin goat herd, you might be able to make some money off these. Of course, they weren't making the kind of money that they probably deserved. At the same time, archaeologists, if you talk to them about this, are very upset that when they came across very few of these caves that were undisturbed. Right. So they don't actually know
what's been taken,
yet. What's been taken, what's not been taken, and so on. And as I said, on the international black market, we know that there were lots of scrolls that have never made it into the open. So that's another issue, is that we're probably not missing any of the big, complete manuscripts. Those are probably accounted for. But there's probably a lot out there that we don't know about. And there's even some forgeries in recent years, taking advantage of the fact that we don't know what we don't know, that have emerged in recent years. The Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C. has actually bought several of these forgeries that have turned out to be forgeries over the years. So in any event, I'll say it's a contested issue, but yeah. So one of the things that archaeologists are doing is trying to figure out what exactly this community is for. As I said, there's a problem, there's an argument about whether or not this was a fortress, or did this not have anything ever to do with the scrolls. That's not the majority opinion. The majority opinion is that this was a community of people who did make some of these scrolls, not all of them, but collected these scrolls, and probably were a religious community, perhaps religious and political, mixed together. In the ancient world, those were not separate. But they seem to have had an assembly and dining hall, some sort of big, long room where people could all meet together, a couple hundred people probably at any point in time in this community. There was definitely some industrial work on this site. We know that there was a big pottery kiln. Remember, they made some of those scroll jars on site. We also have some other pottery demands. We also know that they imported some pottery as well from other areas, from Jerusalem and from Jericho. They imported red ink for some of the stuff that they wrote. That red ink can only come from two places. It can come from Spain, or it can come from China in the ancient world. So they were connected to international trade routes. So they were local, like making some of their own things and writing some of their own texts. They were also collecting manuscripts that we know did not come from this community. They had some manuscripts in their collection that came from 100 years before this, or more, before this community even existed. So this is to say that they were both an isolated wilderness community, and they had connections to the global economy. It's a very interesting mixture of folks. There's a room that people think is called some of the archaeologists have called the scriptorium. It's debated whether this is an actual scriptorium or not. That is to say, some of the early archaeologists, influenced by Roland DeVoe himself, a Catholic monk, may have thought of this community as basically a monastic community. So they based it, their reconstruction, on medieval monasteries, which all had scriptoriums. Some people have used this to say that, let's throw out that idea because that can't possibly be true. At the same time, maybe it was. In that scriptorium, there were found up to 7 inkwells. So, like, literally wells used for ink. So you wouldn't have had these if you weren't actually producing manuscripts. So I do think this was probably an area where they used to write. And there seem to have been some big, long tables in this room. There's some remains of that. It seems to have been a two-story area as well. So there might have been two levels of scripture writing or script writing. But we also, one of the other things that's amazing from this site, there is a tower for defensive purposes. Some people have said this may have been, you know, this is why it was just a fortress. I think they probably did have a tower for defensive purposes, but they also probably wasn't primarily what they were there for. But one other thing is that the water, the way they had to manage water, because they were an isolated community in the middle of the wilderness where it only rained a few times a year, you can imagine, right? But also it seems that this was a part of their religious identity. They didn't just have the water there in a cistern to drink. They did have a cistern, and the cistern might be older than the community, which is interesting, older than the other buildings. But they did have cisterns and other ways for damming up water and keeping water, like huge reservoirs of water for the entire year. But they also had these baths, these immersion baths, stairs going down to an area that held water. Now, I don't know if you've been to a synagogue or if you've been to a Jewish community center and so on, but you've probably heard of the shvitz, right? Or you've heard of the mikveh. Right? That is to say, water and this idea of kind of purification or getting ready for worship or kind of purity in a way other than just washing your hands has been a part of the Jewish tradition and is a part of the Muslim tradition and so on for many years. It's part of the Christian tradition too. We call it baptism. Yeah. So people have talked about these kind of baptistries and so on. I'd rather call them mikvotes. That is to say, they're more like the Jewish purification baths that you still find today in Jewish communities. These ways that you kind of symbolically purify yourself using water. The problem is it only rains a couple times a year here. Everyone is cleansing themselves in these baths. Yeah. People who lived in Qumran, actually, if you look at the bones, they died young from disease often. So it seems that this was actually not the cleanest site in the world. However, ritual purity and actual cleanliness are two very different things. Yes, question.
This was a family community of men, women, children.
Great question. So according to Josephus, these were just communities of men. These kind of Essene communities out in the wilderness were just male-dominated communities, and there were a few women probably involved. In the documents that this community had, there are provisions for families. The other thing is we have a cemetery nearby, which is mostly male bodies, but also some women are buried there. So all to say, but it's a disproportionate. It's a very small group of women who are buried there, but women are buried there. So the question is, who gets buried in the cemetery? Do other people get buried in other ways? Or, do people visit this community for a while and then go home? Did certain people live there all the time and certain people visit? Just like the monasteries here in Georgia, you can visit for a short amount of time. Doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman, but you might go home from that. So we don't actually know a lot of these details. They have all information that they wrote down in their scrolls about who they were and how they worked, but they are very imprecise on some of the details that we would love to know, including could men and women join? Again, some of the texts seem to suggest that women could join this community, and other texts seem to not mention women at all. So we have a disparity here, but great question. But so here's a modern reconstruction of it. You can see some of these pictures. I'll post this on the Google Drive site so you can see the PowerPoint. But it would have been, again, lots of water kind of flowing through the community for all these ritual and purposes of cooking and cleaning and so on, but also for these ritual purposes. In this major cistern and dam project, here's the tower for defensive purposes, and this is what we would have thought would be the scriptorium, this kind of writing center. So it's not very large, and what's amazing is we have not found places where people would have lived. Where did they live? There's one text, this part of the Dead Sea Scrolls, that talks about a camp. That is to say, maybe they camped out, and this was like the buildings that they had were actually not used for living. This would make sense because these people seem to have depicted themselves as, just think about it. They loved scripture, the scriptures of ancient Israel, what we call the Old Testament. They loved these texts. Can you think of a time when Israel was out in the wilderness for a long period of time? 40 years in the wilderness, right? And what did they do for housing? They had tents and they camped, right? That is to say, some people have suggested that maybe that's why there's nothing left behind from their living facilities. Because they were camping in the wilderness, because they saw themselves as the Israel in the wilderness during this terrible time. Yes, question.
This is an engineering question. But how do they get the water in the cistern? Did they have a stream they diverted or something? I mean, it looks
great
like
question.
Where the water comes from is a long way down.
So where's the water? The water doesn't actually come from a long way down. So the Dead Sea is undrinkable, right? So that's what the water in the area filters into. But the water actually comes from up. From the hills. So these torrential downpours flood down the hills and into the wadi, this usually dry riverbed that fills up and flash floods every so often and then fills up to the brim. So then you have this huge amount of water. And that's right next to this community. So down the mountain, when the water's coming down the mountain, they have these diverters that divert the water into the well and into the cistern area. And so then they can basically built a dam coming off the mountain to be able to hold the water. So, all said. So here's some of the ink wells. Here's the scriptorium. Those are that one on the left. There's a color image of the ink well. Here's just an image of the scriptorium. What would it maybe been like? That is to say, these scrolls that we found in the caves, or not we, but people found in the caves. None of them were found here in Qumran. That is to say, they probably pulled these things off of the whatever shelves were used to house them. In this reconstruction, there's kind of a library area and then a production of texts area. In the libraries that we know from the ancient world, there were little cubbies that texts, rolled up scrolls, would have been held in. People would have pulled them out of the cubbies to consult them and then put them back in the cubbies. We know this from ancient Egyptian and Greco-Roman remains. So this is probably what that little area looked like. And here's another modern image of what that scriptorium area looks like now. also that dining hall or whatever, this long room, probably used for communal meals based on some of the archaeological remains. There were apparently several rows of tables where people ate. In the next room over, there were 1,000 complete pottery vessels that were found, including 708 cups, 210 plates, 108 salad bowls. They were never fired, so they were producing a lot of pottery, it seems, on the site. And here's the baptismal pool that I showed you. This, people call them baptismal pools, these mikvaot, these Jewish ceremonial baths that people have connected to the early Christian obsession with baptism. We'll talk about the connection to John the Baptist in just a moment, but John the Baptist seems to be connected to some of this ritual use of water in the Second Temple period, but he does it a bit differently than they did it at Qumran. And lastly, just an image of the cemetery. Some of these different graves covered with stones. Only a few of the bodies have been exhumed so far. There's about 1,100 burials. About 50 have been excavated. And I'm guessing that they're using some sort of imagery to figure out why they would exhume some and not others. But like I said, there have been several female burials that have been found among the 50 that have been excavated.
Two questions.
Yeah.
Do we know what their diet was like from what we found there? What were they eating?
They were eating a pretty regular diet. That is to say, they probably imported some things, but they also probably had some, again, it was a bit more wet there than it is now, but the area was able to sustain some farms. There's been suggestions that some of these communities near the Dead Sea actually owned farms kind of a little further out and imported their food from them. But these folks seem to have been wealthy, or at least had access to wealth. The reason I say that is, again, they were connected to these global trade routes for some luxury items, but scrolls themselves were luxury items. You know, if you think about it, a parchment, a giant piece of parchment, 100-foot-long piece of parchment, that's all leather. 100-foot-long leather jacket that you're riding on. You have 1,000 of these things. Today, that's expensive. Imagine what it would have been like in the ancient world. So this would have been a community of tremendous wealth, but also strange austerity. So their remains, their material remains, do not have valuable items except for some of these items associated with writing. So there seems to have been an austere community that nevertheless had access to tremendous wealth. So they probably imported some of their food, but they seem to have eaten barley and, you know, like some of the cereals and so on. And they also did not perform animal sacrifice. So they talk about animal sacrifice a lot, and they're priests, or at least they talk about themselves as if they're kind of related to priests, but they are themselves not. They are not performing animal sacrifice, and perhaps not eating meat. So, in any event, here's a picture of the watchtower, just to show you kind of where this is near the Dead Sea. This is kind of looking southward on the Dead Sea toward Masada and so on. This site, give you one last look at it, probably would have had some farms and orchards nearby, would have been able to support hundreds of people. It's a bit unclear.
Where would the tents have been if they
did? In the area surrounding this in some way, yeah. But we're not exactly sure. There's no archaeological remains for it. We wouldn't expect it to last either. If there would have been a tent city anywhere in the ancient world 2,000 years later, we wouldn't have any evidence of it. So people who are nomadic don't tend to leave much. I mean, there's a lot of pottery here left at the site, but no beds, you know, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes?
The tradition of hiding scrolls in mm-hmm. Pots.
Yeah.
Is that just related to here, or the other stories of that tradition?
That's a great question. Why are they putting these scrolls in pots? The scroll jar thing comes from Egypt. So the Egyptians had scroll jars a long time before they end up using this idea, it seems, at least we have evidence that they use this in the Dead Sea area or in Jerusalem. No one really knows, but my guess is that Jews who have contact with Alexandria and the Jews who are living, Jews in Jerusalem who have contact with Jews in Alexandria in the Greco-Roman world, living in the Ptolemaic Empire, find out about this use of scroll jars. They probably import the scroll jars. The only other scroll jars we have access to from the ancient world all come from Egypt. And most of them come from southern Egypt, an area that was drier. Alexandria, everything's gone, basically. Just too wet. There's no documentation left from Alexandria. And the pottery that is preserved and so on, it has to do with funerary stuff. Anyway, all to say, there's just not a lot left from Alexandria. So we think that it, we think this technology was used to preserve scrolls in Egypt, Ptolemaic Egypt, and then was brought to Jerusalem sometime during the Hasmonean dynasty. And then they begin to kind of carry their precious scrolls in these jars in order to move them around, and especially in times of crisis. So these jars probably would have been somewhere on the site at Qumran. They know the Romans are coming. They grab them up. They stash them in these caves. They fill up one cave. They find another cave. They probably start with the caves nearest to them, and then they end up moving to caves further and further away. Does that make sense, or?
Yeah, I just know there's a lot of stories about,
Nag Hammadi. Well, we can get to the Nag Hammadi Gospels a little bit later, but yes, that's also in Egypt. Those are later, several centuries later, really, early Christian communities that preserve some texts that are buried in the ground. They were also buried in the ground. That is the Nag Hammadi text, the Gnostic Gospels, like the Gospel of Thomas that we have access to. This Nag Hammadi finds, that's similar. They're in scroll jars. They're buried in the ground precisely because these texts were considered heretical by other, so-called Orthodox Christian groups, right? Groups that we would have seen as Christian. The Gnostics we would have seen as pretty different. So we'll talk about some of those Gnostic Gospels next semester when we talk about the early Jesus movement and some of the differences and some of the early different kinds of Gospels. Does that make sense? Yeah. But yeah, great question. Yeah. Hiding in scroll jars is an occupation of ancient Jews. Yeah.
So it also tells us a lot that they're willing to keep in these jars a lot of text beyond the Pentateuch.
Like, yes, I'll get to the contents of these scrolls. I think in just one moment. Let me get to the history kind of this community in just. But yeah, I'll get to the what's in them. Yeah. So in one of the things we know from this archaeological evidence is that in 31 BC there was a massive earthquake. You can see it here in the stairs that went down to one of these ritual baths. This earthquake destroyed part of Qumran. They had to rebuild it and so on. Some people have argue that there's an occupation gap around this time and so on, but it's the really one date we know about. We know about this date from other historical accounts nearby, so we can precisely date when this happened. But the community seems to have been, at least in my opinion, occupied before and after this event. That's all. That's the only kind of date besides the destruction of Qumran we have access to. So if we're going to put this stuff on a timeline, we know that Qumran was destroyed in 68 A.D., We know that Jerusalem was destroyed and the temple in Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 AD by the Romans. So the Romans were systematically destroying Jewish communities, really all around this area, Jewish communities that were resistant to Roman rule. Yeah?
Does it look like there was a battle there, or they just fled and they burned it down?
There's destruction layer, so we're not sure. But we have there's something called the Cave of Horrors nearby. No scrolls found in the Cave of Horrors, but in the Cave of Horrors, there are hundreds of bodies of people who were hiding, and apparently the Romans came and got them. Also, there's in Masada, which is a fortress, right? There was the kind of final suicide pact where. Anyway, we'll get to the story of Masada when we talk about the Romans in December. But great question. Yeah. So I guess that this originated, like the community itself originated sometime around 100 BC. That is to say, there was a fraction within the Sadducean community of people who had been displaced from the temple and temporal leadership sometime around 150. It takes them 50 years to run away to the wilderness and actually make their own community. We could be wrong about this, but this is what a lot of the archaeologists say. Jody Magnus is probably one of the best known experts on the dating of Qumran. She's at UNC Chapel Hill. And then in 31 BC, we've got this massive earthquake. Those are the three dates we've got pretty sure about. Everything else, we don't really know what happened. Just to give you some context, of course, Jesus lives sometime around this time when Qumran existed as a working community, right? Sometime between 5 BC and 30 CE and so on. We have Paul writing and his ministry sometime around here. Qumran is an active community during that time. And then, of course, the production of the Gospels and the production of rabbinic and creation of rabbinic Judaism after the destruction of the Second Temple occurs after Qumran is gone. One of the amazing things is this had to have been a massive community with lots of resources, lots of powerful people who were associated with it, funding it probably, taking part in it. Lots of scrolls there, probably was the biggest library outside of Jerusalem that was in the Jewish world that we know about. And nobody talks about it. Why doesn't Paul talk about these people? Why aren't these people in the Gospels? We don't know. It's very, very interesting. They were ignored by lots of folks, it seems.
When it talks about like Jesus going into the wilderness and stuff like that,
yeah,
it might have been a euphemism for going to to Qumran or something like
well,
that.
Well, what's amazing is when Jesus goes in the wilderness, it seems that he's going kind of alone, right? And this would have been a city out there. Like, this would have been a massive settlement for that region. So when Jesus goes in the wilderness, but yeah, you're right, going into the wilderness means something. And was Jesus hanging out at Qumran getting some food during those 40 days? I don't know. But the way the Gospels tell it is that Jesus is solitary during that time. But going out in the wilderness does mean something important symbolically during this time of Second Temple Judaism. It's true. So we have some, we have lots of different scrolls that were found. I'll get to the kind of content of the scrolls here. We'll end with this. We'll pick up with what's actually in the scrolls next week. So next Sunday, we'll talk in particular about, there's some pretty crazy stuff in there, pretty fascinating stuff too. But we'll talk mostly about the biblical manuscripts for the rest of our time today. So the sectarian ones, those are the ones, that's where all the sexy stuff is. So so we found lots of different kinds of scrolls, some very fragmentary, like I said, little boxes of pieces of parchment, some that were whole and enormous, some that were almost fully intact. The best one I'll show you in just a minute was the Isaiah scroll, the entire book of Isaiah in one big scroll that still exists. So, what are the Dead Sea Scrolls? All these texts, right? 800 to 900 manuscripts. There's actually some argument, right? Because we have shards of scraps of texts, like, is this one the same as this one, right? You know, so people have different ways of recreating these. Also, there's some that we can't account for because we don't know what happened to them. Again, we know some of these things made it to the black market. So over 800 manuscripts, for sure. Everyone agrees on that. Many, many biblical scholars would say over 900. And then everyone admits there's some out there that we don't know about. So around 1,000 maybe manuscripts total. 50,000 fragments are known. So those 50,000 fragments turn into 800 plus manuscripts. So all to say, hard work. We know that most were written in Hebrew, which is surprising to us because you know that during the time of Jesus, which overlaps with the period of Qumran, what did people mainly speak in this area?
Aramaic,
right? Of course, Jesus doesn't really speak Aramaic. He speaks Aramaic-ish, sort of a mixture of Hebrew and Aramaic every time he's speaking in the Gospels that is written in Aramaic. So, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, Jesus says in the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? Eloi, Eloi, that's Hebrew. Lama is Hebrew, and it could be Aramaic, and then Sabachthani is definitely Aramaic. So Jesus is speaking kind of like today, if you go to the border with Mexico, you might hear Spanglish, right? This kind of mixture of Spanish and English and so on. Aramaic, you know, is what you kind of would have gotten, or Aramaic-Hebrew would have been what you got in Jesus' day. But the texts in the Dead Sea Scrolls are mostly written in very good Hebrew. That is to say, these people were writing in what would have been an antique language, an ancient, almost like writing in Latin today. But they would have written it perfectly. So they were scholars. They were very learned folks. So what we definitely have at Qumran is a collection of scholars, intellectual Jewish elite in some way, who were probably politically connected also, we know, to money, connected to money to create this resource. They would have had to have lots of money. And they also were sectarian in some way. They were separate. They saw themselves as being separate from the leadership. So in any event, they wrote in this kind of ancient scholarly language of Hebrew. And then they also wrote some texts in Aramaic, about 5%. So a small percentage of the scrolls written in Aramaic, their day-to-day language. And then also there were some texts written in Greek, which would have been the language of kind of the rulers. The Romans would have ruled in Greek. So, and if you've seen the Mel Gibson movie, The Passion of the Christ, Pilate and Jesus have a conversation in Latin. Sorry, didn't happen. If Pilate and Jesus spoke, it happened in Greek. Right? That is to say, the Romans in the East spoke Greek. Constantine the Great only spoke Greek, right? So that's to say, like, the Roman Empire mostly spoke Greek, especially east of Italy during this time, but also later in the Roman Empire. So the Byzantine Empire, right? We call it the Eastern Roman Empire. So in any event, Greek would have been the language of the elite, and they actually had texts from the Bible translated into Greek. So we think this would have been from the community in Alexandria, Egypt. So there's some literary connections even to the Jews living in Alexandria at the time. We'll get more into them in a few weeks when we talk about the diasporic Jews. So there are international connections with this group. We think sometime, you know, 2nd century BC to 1st century AD, these texts are being written. Some of them even seem to date before the community exists. So that is to say, they imported some scrolls that to them were already ancient. The most ancient of them seem to be astronomical texts related to the Book of Enoch from sometime around the year 250 BC. And then Ecclesiastes. There's a copy of Ecclesiastes from sometime around 250 BC. Crazy that ends up there. But in any event, Most, like I said, a fragmentary, about 20 are complete scrolls. They're on vellum or parchment, some animal skin, a few papyrus. The rest of the papyrus probably disintegrated. They probably had a lot of papyrus that they wrote things on. Papyrus would have been like scratch paper or ostraca. We have some like pots that broke, and they would use that as scratch paper back then. So we have some of those things as well. Like I said, recovered between 1947 and 1956 from 11 caves in the vicinity of a building complex at Qumran. There were other caves that seemed to have had stuff in them that vanished. So Cave 12, Cave 13, there's remains that suggest that there were scrolls there at some point, but they're gone now. Yeah.
How unique is this community? Do we have other examples of...
Nothing like it. We know of nothing like this. That is to say, I pointed out at the beginning, there were 7 different places where we found scrolls hidden in caves along the Dead Sea, Masada being another one. But Masada and some other places like it were royal retreats. So Herod rebuilds Masada. It's probably used by the Hasmoneans before that, but rebuilt by Herod as a wonderful, beautiful mountain retreat for him to go to when it's, you know, like when it's pretty hot, right? So you can go up in this mountain side and enjoy the cool breezes and so on. It had luxury items everywhere. It did have some manuscripts there, but those manuscripts are all in luxury editions. This, I'll get to in a minute. The scrolls at Qumran, some of those are in luxury editions, but most of them are, we can tell, working scrolls. That is, scholars have, they have scholarly notations on them. We know that scholars are using, they're scratching out stuff, they're writing stuff on it. The stuff at Masada is sort of a wealthy individual's library, which we know from the Roman world, from the Greek world, that existed. But those seem to be very different from scholarly institutional libraries, which is more like what Qumran looks like. So fascinating to us that this seems to have been the only thing like it. Maybe something like this existed in Jerusalem, but we don't know. We don't have a lot of access to that. Maybe the temple would have had a library like this for scholars to come visit and work. So this would have been the sectarian sort of opposite to the library in the temple. So next week we'll talk a little about what they had to call the temple scroll, which is one of the texts at Qumran, which seems to have said that this is the new temple, or this is like a place of wandering until we get to the point where we can rebuild a new temple.
Of all these 800... Are there a lot of duplications of the same thing?
The great question. Are there duplications of some of these texts? Yeah, the next slide is a bunch of different lists of, like, what's the most popular, what are the greatest hits of Qumran? Yeah, so I'll get to that in a second. Yeah.
No. Well, the scrolls found around Masada are not part of the Dead Sea Scrolls.
So when people say Dead Sea Scrolls or the scrolls or the texts of the Judean desert, they often mean just Qumran. But really, when scholars use that phrase, the Dead Sea Scrolls, they're also referring to all these other 7 scroll finds. So there's Nahal Hever is a place that was an ancient, like, basically Hasmonean hideout, and a royal hideout. And there's a scroll of the 12 prophets found there, a wonderful text, really helpful for biblical scholars, written in Greek, amazing, but also was a luxury item that was not used by scholars, we don't think. It was just taken along with other treasures to be hidden there in the wilderness.
So the scrolls in Masada are part of the 800?
No. So this is part of this. This should be written a bit differently, probably. The Qumran Dead Sea Scrolls. Yeah. Those are the 800 texts. So in Masada, but in these other places, we didn't find a whole lot. So in the Hal Hever, you have a manuscript of the prophets. So at Qumran, we have this massive group of scrolls that would have been used as some sort of institutional library. But yeah, great point. So this is the Qumran Dead Sea Scrolls is what I'm talking about here. And when you hear scholars speak in public about the Dead Sea Scrolls, they're almost always talking about just the Qumran scrolls. That is to say, like, in our scholarly world, Dead Sea Scrolls mean something a little bit bigger, but no one cares about Masada very much. So, I mean, people care about the story of Masada, it's dramatic, but the texts actually found there, not many people care about. Yeah.
Another question, you're probably going to talk about it later, but when the Romans destroyed Qumran, were all the inhabitants killed? Or were they scattered? Did they go other places?
We don't know. What we do know is that we stop hearing this kind of Judaism. We hear little bits and pieces of this kind of Judaism that end up becoming part of rabbinic Judaism. But what we know is that the Pharisees win after the Roman destruction. The Romans basically annihilate the wealthy elite, and they annihilate the priestly class, of which these folks would have been a sectarian part. That is to say, they seem to not like the priests in Jerusalem, but they themselves remained people who were connected to the priesthood in general, and they seem to be connected to the wealthy elite. they were systematically destroyed by the Romans. So we don't know here or if they were chased somewhere else. We're not really exactly sure. Were these some of the folks in the Cave of Horrors? I don't know. But what we do know is that the people who lived and survived tended to be, they sided eventually with the Pharisees. So did these folks, some of them kind of just become Jews of the post-Second Temple period? We're not sure. Yeah, it's a great question,
bones
though.
Bones that you found?
Mm-hmm. In the cemetery, yeah.
Oh, no, in the cave.
Oh, the Cave of Horrors, yes.
What year was that?
68, so right around the time that Qumran was destroyed.
And there was like 100 people?
You know, I don't know the exact numbers. I'll read back up on that when we get to the last week of the December of this semester when we talk about the Roman era. Yeah, we'll talk about the destruction.
How many people do you think were in that community?
Well, it's debated. I mean, do they often have visitors? You know, that's the question. Do people come to this place to study, as you know, to use it as a scholarly resource? Do they come here to kind of live for a while? We know that there are certain people that really lived there based on the texts that we found there. But it could have varied a lot in terms of its population. But it seems to support 1,000 people. Or the facilities seem to suggest that from all the plates and cups that we have access to. I mean, maybe there's a core of 500 people and there's like you can house up to 1,000 or, you know, can support up to 1,000 at certain times. But yeah, it's the cemetery only has 1,000 people in it, though. So does that tell us that the community was built to support maybe a festival that people come at a certain time in the year? You know, so we don't really know is the answer. And unfortunately, the texts don't really give us a whole lot of detail. But let me get to this, and we'll finish with the last these last two little bits of information here. What's actually in these texts, these Qumran scrolls from the Dead Sea? About 25% of them are biblical texts. Now, what we know from this, though, at the time, like what we can figure out is that there was no Bible back then. We know this for a fact based on the Dead Sea Scrolls. They didn't have a Bible. What they had were the texts that we find in our Bibles, they had alongside lots of other texts. They did not have certain scroll jars that only had like biblical texts in them. Everything's mixed up. The stuff that we have in our Bibles plus stuff that we don't have in our Bibles, they held together. And they seem to treat a lot of stuff as scripture that we wouldn't treat as scripture, like the Book of Enoch. Like the Book of Jubilees. Yeah, question.
Their versions of the biblical books, are they very, very similar, or are there some key differences?
Great question. So the question is, do these represent kind of what's in our Bible? And what we find, what we now know from the Dead Sea Scrolls is that there were different categories or families of texts. Some books in our Bible had very different kind of text families that coexisted at the time of Jesus. The Psalms is one of these. So you know there's five books of Psalms? Well, there's versions at Qumran of the Psalms that have, like, book one is for sure book one. And then book two is pretty different, and then book three isn't there. And, you know, book three, four, five just are gone, right? Or then there's, like, some kind of crazy stuff about, like, exorcism at the end of it. And then the stuff about how David sang lots more songs than this. What we can tell, what that suggests to us, at least, is that the five books of Psalms actually kind of built up over time. Psalm 1 is, book 1 is the earlier one, book 2 is later, and so on. Book 5 is the last one. If you've ever heard of the Psalms of Ascents, kind of near the end of the Psalms, a lot of people say those are Persian period, those are late kind of Second Temple texts, and so on. So that actually corresponds to what we kind of find in these early Psalters. But then also they have versions of the Psalms that look a lot like ours, in the same scroll jar. And one doesn't say bad. They both seem to be consulted, they both seem to be kind of considered scripture. So what this suggests, and there's other books like Daniel, there's two very different versions of Daniel held at Qumran. Chapters 4 through 6 of Daniel are entirely different in one of these manuscript versions. The other one they've got, and both of them seem to be considered scripture. Another issue is, the Pentateuch, so like the laws and the Torah. There's certain versions of some of these books, like Deuteronomy, that are heavily synthesized. That is to say that people have definitely systematically gone through and tried to make all the laws match in Exodus and Deuteronomy and Leviticus. They tried to kind of work them together, harmonize them in a way. That seems to have been a tendency of this community. But they also have the other versions of Deuteronomy that disagree with Exodus. And they don't say bad. You know, they didn't burn them. Another issue is Jeremiah. There's a version of Jeremiah that's preserved by the Greek translation, the Septuagint. So the Greek Orthodox Church has a version of Jeremiah that it treats as scripture that's 20% longer than what you'll find in your Bible. I'll find in my Bible. 20% more Jeremiah, right? Good or bad? I mean, Well, Qumran has both of them. Jerome, who translated the version of the Bible that you and I use as our base text of the Bible, Catholics and Christians alike use this kind of version as our base text, Jerome's translation from the Hebrew, sometime around the year 400 AD, and Jerome decides to not use the Greek text as its basis because he couldn't find Hebrew manuscripts that held up some of the differences. So he thinks the Greek translators added some stuff and took away some stuff. That 20% added in Jeremiah, Greek people made that up. Guess what? Now we have Hebrew versions of those texts found at Qumran. Same with Ben Sira. Jerome takes it out of the Bible and demotes it because, number one, the Jews don't use it as Holy Scripture. Christians at his time do, but also he can't find Hebrew texts. But guess what? We found at Qumran Hebrew versions of Ben Sira. Sirach. So all to say, like, you know, this makes Christians think a little bit, right?
Yeah. That still goes on today. Like, you've got different versions of Mark that has the last couple of chapters or something like that.
Exactly. So this has brought up a lot of questions. So, again, there are versions of, like, the book of Isaiah, the great Isaiah scroll. It's pretty much word for word what you've got in your Bible. It's amazing, right? 2,000, it's 1,000 years before the next kind of full manuscript we have of Isaiah. You know, we found something 1,000 years before what we had previous, and it's identical. Awesome. Also, there's some of these weird versions that they have next to it. So, all to say, the idea of the canon, a closed list of books in, out, seems to have developed after the time of Jesus. At the time of Jesus, there was what some people call fluidity, textual fluidity. Like, versions of books were, like, there were some different versions of books that were what's called pluriform, different versions that were held together, and you didn't have to choose. It's okay. It's okay that there's two different versions of the book of Psalms. God can speak through this one. God can speak through this one. And what we know, too, is that there was this idea that there was like a heavenly library where all the works of God are held, but it's too big. It's too many. You can't possibly have enough. Like at the end of that strange Psalm scroll, 11Q Psalms A, we'll get to some of these particular texts next week. But it ends by saying that David wrote thousands of Psalms that we don't have access to. That is to say, of course there's different versions of the book of Psalms. What we have in texts are little shards of the heavenly library. So, I'll say that's kind of the big deal. But then we have some administrative documents, but then about 30% of the texts are sectarian texts that people at Qumran wrote about their weird little community, or weird big community. Weird because it seems to not align with some of the other aspects of Judaism that we see in its time and place. So we'll get to some of those sectarian texts. We'll focus on those next week. Who are these people? And then lastly, there's some of the things that we find in some Christian Bibles and not others. That is to say, the Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha. So what do they like? They like Psalms. And they wrote their own Psalms. One Q Hodiot. The Hodiot are their own Psalms that they wrote for their own community. They also have Psalms of the Sabbath Sacrifice. They wrote their own Psalms for their... they couldn't sacrifice out there. They didn't have a temple out there in the wilderness. So what did they do? They prayed instead. This is part of the Jewish procedure. If there's no temple, you pray, and God accepts those as your sacrifices. So the songs of the Sabbath sacrifice are built on the Psalms you find in the Bible. They loved the Psalms. They sang them a lot. It's part of the community formation. Also, Deuteronomy. They loved Deuteronomy. The legal stuff in there, the ritual stuff, the ideas of purity that they found in Deuteronomy and in Leviticus, they loved. Isaiah seems to have been a hugely important text. 21 copies of Isaiah. So 36 copies of the Psalms, 27 copies of Deuteronomy, 21 copies of Isaiah. The prophecies in Isaiah, they seem to think were part of their own day. We're speaking to them at that moment. They're not the only community of Jews at that point in time who thought that Isaiah was speaking directly to them. Like the Emmanuel prophecy, God with us, right? So the other Jewish communities were seen as referring to them. First Enoch, one of the most popular books at Qumran. Not in Christian Bibles outside of the Ethiopian Orthodox community. Remember, we talked about Enoch, though. Hugely formative for the ideas of evil. We'll see this pop up again next week. The ideas of evil and of salvation, of the afterlife that we find at Qumran, are similar to, but also really different from Christianity. And they seem to align with this Enochian Judaism. So Exodus, Jubilees, another one of these texts we talked about last week. It's kind of strange form of like retelling of Genesis. And then Genesis itself. Also, we find a text, only one copy of it, called the Genesis Apocryphon, like another retelling of Genesis. They loved retelling the story of Genesis. You'll also find some kind of fan fiction, like stories of Daniel that we don't find in the Bible. That people kind of wrote extra stories about Daniel because they loved it, you know? So anyway, we find 8 copies of Daniel, 8 copies of the 12 prophets all written on one scroll. But then you also find 10 or so copies of extra stories of Daniel. There's a story of... The only biblical book you won't find in the Dead Sea Scrolls is Esther. But there's a book called Proto-Esther. in the Dead Sea Scrolls. That is to say, it's a story. It sounds a lot like Esther, but it's fragmentary, so we don't have a whole lot of it. But it's not Esther. It's not, none of it's found. Yeah, you know, it's about a woman who is kind of stands up to the king and so on in the Persian Empire. So all to say that this world out there that's being created by these texts, we'll delve a bit more into the local community next week. But so that's basically these biblical texts. The amazing thing about it is, the next biblical texts that we have access to archaeologically are from 1,000 years later. So this is the most amazing find. The Dead Sea Scroll community, but also the Qumran community, but also the other scrolls in the Dead Sea, provide us a window into history 1,000 years before any of us had access to before that. So pretty much amazing. By the way, here's the Isaiah scroll, just so you can see it rolled out there. That's stitched together. This is animal skin. If you put your hand on it, you can feel the follicles of hair, from the animal skin, and it's stitched together by hand. Giant scroll would have just weighed so much, Okay, so next time we'll come back together and we'll talk about some of these very fascinating sectarian texts that define, or at least help us begin to define, who exactly was a part of this community and why.
This podcast is a ministry of First Presbyterian Church of Marietta. Come join us Sundays at 189 Church Street, Marietta, Georgia, or visit us online at fpcmarietta.org.